What's up, monster kids? You staying up way too late watching Bela Lugosi and Vincent Price on TV? Well, I've got the podcast for you. Cobwebs, a gothic cinema podcast in which I, Daniel Epler, and a rotating panel of guests dive into the history of the gothic horror genre and its influence on cinema today.
Now, before the party begins, let's go over the details.
I'm talking Hammer Horror, Universal Monsters, Edgar Allan Poe, and even the modern stuff that draws inspiration from those.
There are dark corners. Horror's almost impossible to imagine.
So if you've always felt you'd be a little more at home in a Transylvanian castle with the vampires in the crypt, then head to cobwebspodcast.com or check us out on major podcasting platforms. Cobwebs, a gothic cinema podcast guaranteed to give you the spooks.
Welcome to another special episode of the Dead Ringers podcast, live from Fantastic Fest 2019. I'm joined by the same crew as I have been for the entire festival, which is Paul Farrell, Kat Adams, and Emily Von Zela. And like before, we're just going to get right into it, because we got a lot of movies to cover and not a lot of time to talk about them.
So, we are talking about day five. The first thing up, I think, for all, well, Kat, I think you skipped, but all of Emily, Paul, and I, we also have Vivarium with Jesse Eisenberg and Imogen Poots. And it's like a couple sort of looking for a house. They get taken to this weird neighborhood and then kind of can't escape and get left with a baby and are told to raise it.
Welcome to hell. Someone just hands you a baby in a box.
Right? Like, that's the worst case scenario for having a child. You get lost in a horrible thing by yourself, and they're like, raise this child or you can't leave.
Yeah.
You're like, I am ill-prepared for this.
Nobody wants a box baby.
No.
Yes.
Also, it brought back all of the stressors I had when I was house hunting. And it's been a couple of years, but yeah, it's still terrible.
Did a weird guy bring you to like a suburbia with identical homes and leave you there for eternity when you were house
hunting? Thank God, no, but okay. It honestly is something that could have happened.
Yeah, seems feasible.
So what did you guys think of it overall?
I liked the premise. I really liked the performances, especially Imogen Poots. She was really rad, but I think that the concept maybe was a little bit lighter than the feature length of the film. It felt like it kind of dragged in the middle.
Yeah.
But it went some pretty weird places, and I like that.
Yeah. What about you, Paul?
Yeah, I pretty much agree. I think the performances were great, especially Imogen Poots. Who I really like in general. It's just very charming to watch on screen. But it felt like sort of a... You know, I've compared a lot of movies this year to Black Mirror, Twilight Zone, just because they all kind of have that sort of, like, weird mystery with sort of a twist ending, you know, kind of a punctuation mark at the end, you know, that feels like those types of things stretched out. And this one in particular, I felt the length to get there. Yeah. Because part of the problem is if you make a movie where two people are trapped in an empty suburbia, there isn't much for them to do. And, like, because of that, we end up watching them do very little for about an hour. And that stuff got a little bit wearing on me. And then I also kind of struggled with their character motivations sort of change really dramatically from scene to scene, I guess because they're under so much duress with the raising of the child. Yeah, there's a child that's sort of I don't think it's much of a spoiler to say that it's rapidly aging.
Yeah.
And it's like the most annoying on-screen kid ever, which it's supposed to be.
It beats the Babadook kid.
It does
sure.
beat the Babadook kid.
Because it just parrots everything that the parents say.
Right.
Because get it? Your children learn from you.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is it had some really heavy-handed themes about, like, suburban life and giving up your dreams to, you know, have that sort of nuclear family. And I think that it was trying to get at a lot of stuff that sort of got muddy along the way. So anyway, I think there's some fun stuff to it. It's very sleekly made. And parts of the ending I did really enjoy, like when you finally do get to something that happens. But overall, I think it would have been better served as like a 50-minute episode of Twilight Zone or Black Mirror.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I mean, you guys have pretty much covered it. But yeah, like there's a, it gets more interesting once you hit like really probably like the last 15 minutes, but like it needed to get to that reveal way earlier. And like you were saying, Paul, like they repeat beats a lot because they don't know what to do, or they just drag out scenes because like you're saying, like they're kind of padding time. Mm-hmm. And so it would work as a short or a, like, you know, like you said, like a Black Mirror or Twilight Zone episode, but as is, it ends up feeling like, I guess like the biggest thing is that like we're talking about like the sort of commentary or whatever about parenthood life and all that, but like it feels like it's saying things you already know and then not like developing any further. It's not like trying to make a statement. It's just like, for me, like the whole movie would make more sense if at the end the director's head popped out on the screen and was like, life, right? Or like parenthood, right? It just felt like, it's just so...
I would have liked the movie a lot more if that's how it ended.
Yeah. And it's like really, not to spoil everything, but like the movie is counting on you, one, not knowing what a vivarium is. So if you look it up in the beginning, you're going to have a clue. And then it broadcasts what it's doing so early, but then doesn't really, again, do anything with it. Mm-hmm. So, which is kind of the issue. It's just like it is what it is on the surface, basically. Which is a shame, because again, yeah, those performances are good. And yeah. So, not a huge fan of that one, but it was well made, just not,
yeah,
it's not going to stick with me in any way. Mm-hmm. And then after that, Kat and I saw Prey, which was a repertory screening, which you signed us up for, because based on Phil Noble's recommendation, right?
Yeah, you're going to throw that on me. Phil Noble had seen it and liked it. So I thought we could check it out. It was at a slot where there wasn't a ton of other stuff. It's from 1977. It is interesting. No, mm-hmm. it features these two women, lesbian couple, sort of have this estate home in England, and an alien inserts himself into their life, and which was not particularly stable or healthy to begin with. Havoc ensues. Humans are high in protein and an easy prey.
Yeah,
that's the film. There was a recorded message from the director beforehand about how he had been approached to do this film and he agreed to it. And then it turned out it didn't have a script. It didn't have a cast. It really didn't have anything. And he had 3 weeks to put that together, then 10 weeks to shoot it. And he said, you know what you see, we recorded the first draft of the script and I'm pretty proud of it, honestly. And under those conditions, yeah. It sometimes feels like a first draft of a script. It's really slow. It's a little bonkers at times. There is a sex scene where I leaned over and said, did anyone on set know what lesbians do in bed? And then the first thing the director said in the recorded message after was, none of us knew what lesbians did in bed. And it shows. And it's obviously not, it's actually an archetypal sort of abusive relationship from, you know, maybe from a time when things were not nearly as progressive as they are now, or at least there were fewer depictions of women in relationships with women. So it does sort of play on some harmful predatory archetypes. That said, it was ahead of its time just in representation in general, mm-hmm. I think. The alien looks like a werewolf.
He's got like a dog nose and vampire teeth.
Which is funny because at one point, Jessica does say Joe made her get rid of all her dogs because she thinks they're horrible and stinky. And Joe is awesome. Pretty much as often as possible voicing anti-male sentiment. So it sort of lumps him in with that, I guess. Or it could have just been what the makeup artist knew to do. So they went with that.
Mm-hmm. Whenever you see alien, it's pretty silly. But like the weird sort of like dynamics between the three is what is actually interesting about the movie. I agree. It was a little too slow for me. I definitely, maybe tuned out a little bit at one point because I got a little sleepy. But
like just seeing the, yeah, like weirdly enough, this sort of reminded me a lot of Vivarium, which I saw right before this, and the sort of dynamic of the relationship where you have like an outsider coming in and like the, this couple that's sort of ultimately divided because one of them is more sympathetic to the sort of interloper and it causes a lot of trouble. And yeah, like, I don't know, like if you're, I forget if this was Vinegar Syndrome or AGFA, but it's, you know, people who like those types of 70s weirdo pictures will definitely be into it, probably. Maybe not as much for me generally, but I, yeah. So it was fun though. It was worth seeing.
And it's only the repertory, it's the only repertory screening I think I'm going to fit in this year. So it was, yeah, I think it was interesting and informative and something I probably wouldn't have seen otherwise. So it wasn't time wasted for sure.
Yeah. And it was also cool because it was like sort of included as part of like their like they've had like a queer block this year, basically. So between the Horror Queers live recording, the
Scream Queen
documentary, there's that. They're showing Lyle, which is a movie from like 2014 with Gabby Hoffman. That's like a Rosemary's Baby sort of thing. But I don't know the different angle, but I know it is a queer angle. And so like, yeah, they like they've done a good job of like showing a lot of that stuff. So like, again, if nothing else, I'm glad I saw it for like sort of understanding some prior context for those types of movies.
For sure.
What did you guys see while we were seeing Prey?
In the Shadow of the Moon.
Yes.
How was that?
There was more time travel in that movie.
Yeah, the theme of time travel keeps coming up. I didn't know, but
I've never been to Fantastic Fest before, so I actually didn't realize there's a rule that every other movie had to be about time travel. Mm-hmm. That no one ever like let me know about that. So yeah, this was our other movie that day about time travel. So
wait, what was the other movie?
And it was another Netflix movie because there's
that has time travel in it.
Yeah,
you said every other movie.
Oh, that was sorry,
it was just a joke. It was a bad joke.
Guys, yeah. I'm tired.
It's okay. We're all tired.
Yeah, In the Shadow of the Moon was...
It's Jim Mickle's new movie.
Yes.
For, like, Stakeland and We Are What We Are. And...
It's fun. It's a little bit too long. Mm-hmm. But Michael C. Hall does a wicked Philly accent in it.
He's the only one.
Yeah, he's the only cast member whose character seems to actually be from Philly. Everyone else, I'm thinking, just moved there in the past 5 years.
Wasn't explained, but yes, yeah. Obviously.
It's a good accent, though. He really nails it.
Yeah. But yeah, it's this story of a cop who runs across this really weird case one night and winds up chasing down this suspect. And then over the course of... Am I spoiling it?
Mm-mm, not yet.
Okay. Over the course of several years across his life, he winds up kind of connecting back with this person in really inexplicable ways and has to try to figure out just why and how this is happening.
Yes.
I don't know how to describe this movie.
It's a hard one, to your point, without giving like the whole game away.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it opens with a scene from like the future. Like
and we already
it tells
said
you
it's
that.
A time travel movie. So we're
yeah,
jumping
so
around
I mean I think it makes it kind
of
makes its game. So here's what I would kind of think. It reminded me, and this is gonna sound like I'm giving it a massive compliment, and I agree with you, I think it was fine. But it kind of obeys the 12 Monkeys principle of time travel. Where it's like I don't think it does it nearly as well as that, but that's what it reminded me of. Where it's like there's these consistent touch points throughout time that there is going to be time travel. And what they do with that stuff can potentially lead to a better outcome eventually.
Yeah.
That's
a good way of saying it.
It follows, if you've seen 12 Monkeys and you like that, elements of this movie will be very satisfying to you. I do not think it executes that premise nearly as well.
Also, yeah. 12 Monkeys is fucking
amazing.
No,
right. So I don't want to split hairs on that. Yeah. But it does adhere to the same principles of that kind of thing. And it's very much about like the choices you make and what you dedicate your life to and like what you might have wished you had in hindsight. So, you know, it kind of deals with the premise of like, at the beginning of the movie, you start with this cop who's, you know, this up-and-coming cop. He's got a bright future ahead of him. He's got a pregnant wife. So, you know, he's got a budding family. You know, this guy's got a bright future. And it's about how the decisions he makes based on his obsessions whether that be selfish or selfless in his own eyes, you know, ultimately can either lead him to a good life or a bad life. But that rests pretty much on his shoulders, not anyone else's, right? Mm-hmm. Even though, you know, people in that moment would like to blame the external things that happened to them for what's become of their life, when in reality it was just decisions they made all along. So, I mean, it does deal with some heady stuff. Like Emily was saying, I think it's really fun. I think it's a fun popcorn, you know, night at Netflix. Like, if you're at home and you just want to watch a fun sci-fi action movie, like, you could do worse than this. But I don't think it brings, like, anything new to the table. And I think some of the time travel stuff falls apart in the end a little bit. But overall, I had a good time.
Yeah, me too. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I feel like that's been most of people's response to it. It's like, pretty good, but
yeah,
got issues.
Good, not great.
And you even said, but like, when you were pitching that, it sounded even more like Synchronic. So it's just like, it's unfortunate that these are both playing at the same thing. Like, I feel like that's a programmer shouldn't do that, because that's...
Synchronic was a better version.
Right. I kind of wish I'd seen this before Synchronic, because my head probably wouldn't have been as picky. I would have just had
possibly. Yeah, because I still would have liked Synchronic either way, because it was really good. And this was probably hurt by the fact that we had just come out of, like, a better version of time travel movie.
Yeah. That's unfortunate.
What'd you see next?
The next thing, I think, three of us saw, but you'd seen early in the festival. We saw The Lodge, which is the new film from the team behind Goodnight Mommy. Mm-hmm. Weirdly enough, has a lot in common with Goodnight Mommy, especially, like, this, the, like, general, like, sort of structure of the plot. But is also very dark but I think actually ends up being a lot bleaker. And like I said, like, Goodnight Mommy for me was good up until the twist. And then the twist sort of broke the movie, because it was just like, kind of did a thing that I felt like has been done too often. And it was just like, okay. Whereas this, like, was wholly satisfying all the way through for me. And like, I think we all agree, like, ended up being like one of my favorite, like, horror movies of the fest, especially, like, as far as like, something that actually got under my skin and, like, creeped me out a lot. What do you guys think?
Yeah, same. It's super bleak. I don't ever want to see it again, but I really appreciated it. And I say that, I know the universe conspires against us. I'll probably end up seeing it again. But it was very satisfying. So, like, even though the content was bleak, the structure of the narrative was complete and followed a clear arc, and there's some semblance of justice at the end, not a necessarily a righteous justice, but something you're happy to see happen. It is a very unfortunate dog death, so heads up if you're sensitive to that. But it was an interesting take on a cult film, because it happens after the person's been traumatized by the cult. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing the ramifications of that trickle through her life after she's escaped it, which was interesting. Had a great Alicia Silverstone that I think we were also surprised to see.
Yeah.
We're like,
I was shocked.
Was that Alicia Silverstone?
Yeah.
She's great. She's not in it very long, but she's great.
I hope she does more genre after this. I'd like to see more of her.
I think the fandom would treat her right.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it does have a couple other, like, big actors. Well, Richard Armitage, who people would know from the Hobbit movies. I think he's... starts with a TH. I can't remember that guy's name. He's like the lead dwarf in The Hobbit. I can't.
Thorin the dwarf.
Thorin. Yes, Thorin. And then it's got Jade Martell from It and Wolf Boys. We'll talk about at a certain point later. So it's a good cast.
Riley Keough. Yeah.
Oh yeah, Riley Keough, like, gives an incredible performance.
Like, the movie could just be about her eyes.
Yes.
And I think you'd still get the gist of the plot.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah,
Michael Keaton makes a cameo.
Doesn't.
But all right.
Looking for it.
I loved it. I agree with everything you both said. For me, it's one of the movies of the fest. It's, you know, it's a very deep, dark dive into a deteriorating family. You know, so kind of like. But it's beautifully composed, beautifully shot. It has some really interesting allegorical stuff thematically in the movie. Keep coming back to, like, a dollhouse thing that was really cool. That, like, when you sort of understand where the movie's head, it's a hard movie to talk about because I don't want to spoil much about it.
Yeah.
But all of the reveals are satisfying. That, you know, I think, like you said, Goodnight Mommy also was really well composed, also was really well shot. But I think people were lost on the story and some of the twists that it took. I think this movie, nothing feels, none of the twists or story feels like disingenuous to the initial premise and what they're exploring. And where it goes is ultimately satisfying within the confines of the narrative, even though it's a really dark sort of place. I really like the snowy setting, mm-hmm. The cold setting, you know, kind of setting it against Christmas, which is supposed to be this really warm, embracing holiday and like sort of deconstructing people at their most vulnerable.
Yeah.
So, no, I thought it was a brilliant movie, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. And you mentioned the dollhouse. It's a comparison to be made. I don't want to set up too high of expectations, but yeah, a lot of, like, we talked about it being similar to Hereditary in a lot of ways. Like, yeah. The dollhouse stuff plays into it in interesting ways. And then it is sort of a movie about, like, the spiral and rippling effect of grief, yeah. And the way it just keeps, like, getting worse and worse for these people. And as people know, you know, I'm not a huge fan of that one. This, for me, was, like, sort of what I wanted from a Hereditary-style movie. So, like, I loved it.
I agree with everything you guys said, and I also loved it.
And nice. Then after that, what did you guys see for the final night of day five?
I saw VHS, which was a ton of fun, and I liked it. The concept is this, it's back in the 80s, and this family gets a camcorder for Christmas, and the 12-year-old kid grabs a tape and just starts recording things, and it happens to be his parents' wedding video. So what you will see, like, clips of the wedding pop up and then be taken over by either clips of him and his friend, like, fooling around with the camera like 12-year-olds do, or he really digs the idea that children, if you weren't alive in the 80s, you could hook your camcorder up to the TV and record things off of the TV. So he was doing that. So it's, the film is interspersed with footage of him and his friend and the different late night shows and commercials that he was presumably recording off of his television. So it's kind of like this big, like, soup of, like, kind of Adult Swim style vignettes that are cut up by commercials and the wedding video footage and he and his friends. So it's just kind of like you sit down and you watch this crazy ass tape of all of this weird shit. And it had I can't remember anyone's name today.
Thomas Lennon.
Thomas Lennon, thank you.
Oh.
Carrie King.
Kenny.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
It has the guy who plays the energy vampire on What We Do in the Shadows.
Oh, now I really want to see those.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that many names to be in it, but that part was a lot of fun because they just kind of, like, let all of those really skilled comedians just kind of do their thing.
Nice.
So Carrie Kinney is, like, she's a woman who has, like, kind of a Bob Ross-style painting show, but the longer we watch her, the crazier she starts coming off.
That's awesome.
I really want to see that. Is it kind of like, is it in the style of WNBA?
Yeah,
it's exactly, it's a little bit like that.
Exactly what I was thinking when she was talking. I was like, oh, this seems like something I'd really
less of a narrative, but there is still kind of a narrative running through the kid's life when we get back to the footage of him with his family. So it's not just like an isolated mixture of stuff.
Awesome. And part of also why it's notable is it's made by Tim Robbins and Susan Sarandon's son. And then are they in it also?
Yes, they both have small parts.
So crazy. But that is crazy. I think he just, like, shot a bunch of it in his backyard or something. I don't know. So I feel like there's...
Oh, yeah, he filmed everything using VHS and Beta.
That's so cool.
Oh, okay. I'm in.
Authentic. Yeah, that's very cool. I wonder if how or what kind of release that movie might get.
But... Oscilloscope has it. So at some point, it's coming out.
Cool. And then... Oh, Kat and I saw Wrinkles the Clown.
I stayed out way past my bedtime to see Wrinkles the Clown because it was the one film I knew coming into Fantastic Fest I wanted to see, and I just needed to see that through.
Yeah. It was a documentary about... So I didn't know about this at all, that there was, like, a clown video that went viral in 2015 about Wrinkles the Clown where this, like, clown was under this little girl's bed, and he, like, sort of... pushes himself out from under a
trundle bed
and, like, climbs up and like leaves like a little doll in her bed. And it's just like, it's really creepy. And like, just the fact that he's like coming out of her bed in that way is just so invasive and terrifying. So like, he became a like sort of viral sensation.
And that was shot like CCTV.
Yes.
Like it was a home security camera. And then people started seeing these stickers around Naples, Florida that had the picture of Wrinkles the Clown, and it just said Wrinkles and had a phone number. Yeah, I don't want to give too much of it away, but it does take a sharp turn towards the end of its runtime that makes it really interesting, and it means the documentary is about more than just Wrinkles the Clown. It's actually using Wrinkles the Clown as an example to talk about some bigger issues, or just the way we deal with media and interact with it and folk tales and things like that. So the idea around Wrinkles the Clown is he is this terrifying clown that you pay to come scare your children into behaving.
Or you can just call the hotline and he'll talk to them. And like, that's all, like so many kids, that's all they needed was as soon as they heard Wrinkles' voice, they lost their shit.
There's actually some sort of upsetting and heartbreaking voicemails you hear of parents calling Wrinkles and telling the kid what they're doing, and these children just screaming like they're being drugged straight to hell out of their homes. And there's evidently a whole subgenre of YouTube videos of kids calling the number and hearing his voicemail and losing their minds. So it's a full-fledged phenom in certain corners of adolescent internet.
Yeah. Yeah, very much like you mentioned the folklore, like it was all about just like the way that we build folklore and mythology in our world and like basically culture. And like, so in addition to this, they were just talking like basically Wrinkles is getting lumped in with stuff like Bloody Mary and all those like sort of classic urban legends where like people use a thing to scare themselves to like in a way that's safe. It, like they were saying, like talking about testing the limits of what's safe and like what you can do.
There's this one kid they talk to who actually
is a doll. Yeah.
Who sums up why so many of us are interested in horror. And he talked about, there's actually two kids who talk about it. One was talking about whenever he's home alone and he'll bring this stuff up on his iPad and he'll just watch it because it makes him, he likes feeling scared. And he talks about sometimes when people are sad, if you scare them,
you can make them happy.
You can make them happy.
You can shake them out of that bad feelings, essentially. Yeah.
And there was a lot of laughter in the theater because of that. And I didn't know what the laughter was. I imagine it was self-identification.
Yeah.
And then there was another kid who, on the other, was terrified of it. And talked about how he took his mattress off his bed so that nothing could be beneath him.
He filled his whole closet with boxes so nothing could be in the closet.
So nothing could be in the closet, which is also very relatable when I was a kid. And he talked about how he would just sort of expose himself to it over and over again until it wasn't scary anymore.
Yeah, like he basically said, like, I scared myself so much that I wasn't scared anymore, which
is also why we go
so many people. And like I've talked about multiple times, that was totally my experience, was like Halloween or like the random movies Ben would show me were terrifying. And the only way at a certain point to get over it is like, I have to like this. Otherwise, it's always going to scare me.
Exactly. I will say, it was 78 minutes long, I believe, and it could have been a tight 40.
Yeah, even with the, like, I don't want to call it a twist, so people, but, like, anyone, well.
Even with its developments, yeah. Late game developments.
Yeah. And I did like the late game development, but, like, it didn't feel like we needed to spend as much time there. But, yeah, it's just, like, that. I don't want to spoil too much either, but like, I feel like people who liked or have seen and liked One Cut of the Dead, there's a little bit of a similar bent about the way this, like we were saying, the twist or the development, whatever you want to call it, like changes the way the movie you're watching, like the way you perceive the movie you're watching. Cause you definitely think Wrinkles the Clown is this one movie for about whatever, 50, 60 minutes. And then like the last bit, like you're like, oh, there's like a whole lot more going on here. And it's just, actually, it's more fascinating, but yeah, yes. I agree. The problem was like, by the time we got there, I was like, okay, like I think I got it all. Like it was just a little, it went on a little too long.
I agree. It didn't need to spend as much time being what it started to be about. And cause where it ended up was actually great. I really liked it, but it took a little too long to get there. But if you do have a chance to see Wrinkles the Clown, you should. It's great.
Yeah, it explores a lot of really interesting topics. So
for sure.
Cool. So while Kat and I were seeing Wrinkles the Clown, Paul, you went to the Fantastic Feud.
I did.
Which is sort of a special event they do there. You'll, like, explain it a little bit, maybe?
Yeah. So obviously this is my first time at the festival, so I had a lot of those same questions that you're having now. So Fantastic Feud is like a Family Feud style game show they do. To be honest with you, I don't really know how they choose the teams. It seems like it's just prevalent voices in the horror film community, including Ari Aster. So yes, quite prevalent. but they do two teams. They go up on stage, and there are trivia questions, some of which were written by our friend of the show, Brad Henderson.
Who oh, really?
Works for Vendor Syndrome, and is off of the Scream Screamcast. One of my favorite podcasts that for some reason I couldn't remember the name of just now. He wrote a bunch of the questions, and then the other questions are were voted on ahead of time by Fantastic Fest attendees, and it shows up Family Feud style. So they'll say, killer kid in a horror movie, and it'll list like eight things. And you have to guess what's probably number one and what's number two. And the higher it's ranked, the more points it gets. But the problem is, as a horror fan, what you want to do is say, like, what you think the best one is or the most accurate. What you have to remember is this is just random people voting. So what's really – what you have to do is guess what's the most likely answer. So, for example, like, literally ranked number three on Killer Kids for all of horror was Brightburn.
Just because it was
– because it's popular and it's new. Now, it's not a movie I ever would have guessed, but it was worth some of the most points. So that's what you have to sort of go into the game knowing, is that it's going to frustrate you in certain ways. Mm-hmm. But the other deal with it is everyone's, like, drinking a lot. Like, the beer and drinks are just flowing, and especially up on stage. So, you know, it's as they go, they get progressively worse at answering trivia. So that's also part of the entertainment. But I was lucky enough to sit next to Phil Nobile Jr. Of Fangoria. So I got to hang out with him for 2 hours and chat. And that was a blast. So, you know, it was cool to sort of see the community come together to do something fun. Have a couple hours away from movies to just kind of unwind and be together and have a good time.
Get rowdy.
Get real, real rowdy. If you go, to be honest with you, if you ever go to Fantastic Fest, I think it's worth going to. And I'll shout out to some of my favorite people who are up on stage. So Heather Wixon was up there, and Trace Thurman, and they were both on the same team. And I'll tell you, Trace owned that stage. And he called out Ari Aster a few times because love the man, love his films. Not the best of trivia. I think he'd be the first to admit it. I think he was a little overwhelmed. And hilariously, on a question regarding cults,
like the cult you'd most want to join,
Ari Aster went up to answer, and the other team got the Midsommar question before Ari Aster. So it was a pretty intense moment.
That's also like, to me, that makes me wonder, it's like the difference between maybe his views of the Harga versus the way that audiences perceive them.
Right. Well, and I also just think it was like, he's there, so they have to put it up there.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was just really entertaining. At the end, they break a pinata, and by then, they're all really hammered. So it was a really fun time, and it was cool to see the community come together like that. So, yeah, I really liked it.
Very cool.
And that's going to do it for Day 5 for Dead Ringers Live from Fantastic Fest. As always, you can follow all of the co-hosts on Twitter. Paul is at PaulIsGreat2000. Kat is at BureauKat, as in BureauKat. And Emily is at HorrellaBlog. Paul's been reviewing pretty much everything he's seen as he goes along, and we'll be publishing all of those in sort of review roundup, diary sort of situations. So keep an eye out on the website for those. And then Emily's coverage you can find on Daily Dead. I'll try to include that in the show links as well. Oh yeah, and you can find me on Twitter at Nolan_McBride, or the show's Twitter handle, which is at Dead Ringers Pod. You can find new episodes of Dead Ringers on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, and TuneIn. If you like the podcast, please subscribe, rate, and leave us a review, as that helps us grow the audience, get the word out, do fun things like this, cover more film festivals and whatnot. We would love to do more of that. So yeah, it definitely helps us out. Thanks, as always, to Thomas Foster for our theme, and Philip Yunt for our artwork and logo. And thanks to everyone who, you know, tunes into the show and shares it. We really appreciate it. As always, on behalf of my co-hosts, thanks for listening and stay spooky.